Escape Pod 156. The 1st of May, 2008. Today's story, Distant Replay, by Mike Resnick.
Hello and welcome to Escape Pod. I'm Steve Ely. This is week two of our Hugo run, and we have a touching bit of magical realism from Mike Resnick. I can already predict two objections to this week's story. One is that we're running magical realism, and the other is that we're doing a Mike Resnick story so soon after the last one. I can give the same answer to both. In fact, I already did. This is week two of our Hugo run. When I started Escape Pod, we did speculative fiction in general. We had fantasy, we had horror, and we had some stuff that was hard to classify. Hello, Tim Pratt. Since then, we've diversified into separate podcasts by genre. Pseudopod started in 06 for the horror, and Podcastle just launched for fantasy, and Escape Pod has refocused itself on science fiction. But the Hugos are not so specific. There are fantasy and horror stories nominated for the Hugo all the time, and spreading them out across the podcasts would get too confusing. The Hugo nominees started on Escape Pod, and they'll stay here. It's a tradition, like Merle Lafferty Christmas stories, and I hope it's one you enjoy. As for Mike Resnick, again, this story was nominated, so having it in the queue was automatic. But I'll confess I do have a special fondness for him over and above that. The first story of his we bought, Down Memory Lane, we bought because it was a 2006 Hugo nominee. He told me a couple of months later that a French film producer had heard the story on Escape Pod and optioned it. So he made some good money from the exposure and became a fan of podcasting pretty quickly. He asked what he could do for me, and I said, just let your colleagues know about us. He did that with enthusiasm. A lot of the major names you've heard on Escape Pod, like Robert Silverberg and Nancy Kress and Robert J. Sawyer, were here because Mike Resnick told them to send us stories. He's been a very good friend to the podcast, which wouldn't by itself prompt me to buy his stories, but as it happens, I also truly like them. So we'll take that as a bio for Mr. Resnick. You've heard the bits about living in Cincinnati and traveling to Africa and being the award-winningest short fiction writer enough times by now. This week, we're proud to present his story, Distant Replay. This story appeared in Asimov's Science Fiction last year. Actually, three of the five nominees were from Asimov's. The story is read for us by Steve Anderson, a freelance actor and writer in Pennsylvania with hundreds of stage and voiceover credits. His current grand project is a touring series of one-man shows known as Great Tales Live, bringing classic literature and history to life. His one-man version of A Christmas Carol as a walking tour through Gettysburg has become famous in the area. You can find Steve's work at sgacreative.com and at greattaleslive.com. So stop me if you think you've heard this before. It's story time.
Distant Replay by Mike Resnick. The first time I saw her, she was jogging in the park. I was sitting on a bench, reading the paper like I do every morning. I didn't pay much attention to her, except to note the resemblance. The next time was in the supermarket. I'd stopped by to replenish my supply of instants, coffee, creamer, sweetener, and this time I got a better look at her. At first, I thought my eyes were playing tricks on me. At 76, it wouldn't be the first time that had happened. Two nights later, I was in Vincenzo's Ristorante, which has been my favorite Italian joint for maybe 40 years, and there she was, again. Not only that, but this time she was wearing my favorite blue dress. Oh, the skirt was a little shorter, and there was something different about the sleeves. But it was the dress, all right. It didn't make any sense. She hadn't looked like this in more than 4 decades. She'd been dead for 7 years, and if she was going to come back from the grave, why the hell hadn't she come directly to me? After all, we'd spent close to half a century together. I walked by her, ostensibly on my way to the men's room, and the smell hit me while I was still 5 feet away from her. It was the same perfume she'd worn every day of our lives together. But she was 68 when she died. Now she looked exactly the way she looked the very first time I saw her. I tried to smile at her as I passed her table. She looked right through me. I got to the men's room, rinsed my face off, and took a look in the mirror, just to make sure I was still 76 years old and hadn't dreamed the last half century. It was me, all right. Not much hair on the top, in need of a trim on the sides, one eye half shut from the mini stroke I denied having, except in increasingly rare moments of honesty. A tiny scab on my chin where I'd cut myself shaving. I can't stand those newfangled electric razors. Though since they've been around as long as I have, I guess they're not really so newfangled after all. It wasn't much of a face on good days, and now I had just seen a woman who was the spitting image of Deirdre. When I came out, she was still there, sitting alone, picking at her dessert. "Excuse me," I said, walking up to her table. "Do you mind if I join you for a moment?" She looked at me as if I was half crazy. Then she looked around, making sure that the place was crowded in case she had to call for help, decided I looked harmless enough, and finally she nodded tersely. "Thank you," I said. "I just want to say that you look exactly like someone I used to know, even down to the dress and the perfume." She kept staring at me, but didn't answer. "I should introduce myself," I said, extending my hand. "My name is Walter Silverman." "What do you want?" she asked, ignoring my hand. "The truth," I said. "I just wanted a closer look at you. You remind me so much of this other person." She looked dubious. "It's not a pickup line," I continued. "Hell, I'm old enough to be your grandfather, and the staff will tell you I've been coming here for 40 years and haven't molested any customers yet. I'm just taken by the resemblance to someone I cared for very much." Her face softened. "I'm sorry if I was rude," she said, and I was struck by how much the voice sounded like her voice. "My name is Deirdre." It was my turn to stare. "Are you all right?" she asked. "I'm fine," I said. "But the woman you look like was also named Deirdre." Another stare. "Let me show you," I said, pulling out my wallet. I took my Deirdre's photo out and handed it to her. "It's uncanny," she said, studying the picture. "We even sort of wear our hair the same way. When was this taken?"
47 years ago.
"Is she dead?" I nodded. "Your wife?"
"Yes."
"I'm sorry," she said. "She was a beautiful woman." Then, "I hope that doesn't sound conceited, since we look so much alike."
"Not at all. She was beautiful. And like I say, she even used the same perfume."
"That's very weird," she said. "Now I understand why you wanted to talk to me."
"It was like I'd suddenly stumbled back half a century in time," I said. "You're even wearing Dee Dee's favorite color."
"What did you say?"
"That you're wearing her."
"No, I meant what you just called her."
"Dee Dee?" I asked. "That was my pet name for her."
"My friends call me Dee Dee," she said. "Isn't that odd?"
"May I call you that?" I said. "If we ever meet again, I mean."
"Sure," she said with a shrug. "Tell me about yourself, Walter. Are you retired?"
"For the past 12 years, I said.
"Got any kids or grandkids?"
"No."
"If you don't work and you don't have family, what do you do with your time?" she asked.
"I read, I watch DVDs, I take walks, I Google a zillion things of interest on the computer."
I paused awkwardly.
"I hope it doesn't sound crazy, but mostly I just pass the time until I can be with Dee Dee again."
"How long were you married?"
45 years, I answered. "That photo was taken a couple of years before we were married. We had long engagements back then."
"Did she work?" asked Deirdre. "I know a lot of women didn't when you were young."
She illustrated children's books, I said. She even won a couple of awards. Suddenly, Deirdre frowned. All right, Walter, how long have you been studying me? Studying you, I repeated, puzzled. I saw you jogging a couple of days ago. I watched you while I was eating. Do you really expect me to believe that? Why wouldn't you? I asked. Because I'm an illustrator for children's magazines. That was too many coincidences. Say that again. I illustrate children's magazines. What's your last name? I asked. Why? She replied suspiciously. Just tell me, I said, almost harshly. Aronson. Oh, thank God. What are you talking about? My Dee Dee's maiden name was Kaplan, I said. For a minute there, I thought I was going crazy. If your name was Kaplan, I'd have been sure of it. I'm sorry I lost my temper, said Deirdre. This has been just a little, well, weird. I didn't mean to upset you, I said. It was just, I don't know, like seeing my Dee Dee all over again. Young and beautiful, the way I remember her. Is that the way you always think of her? She asked curiously. The way she looked 45 years ago. I pulled out another photo, taken the year before Dee Dee died. She was about 40 pounds heavier, and her hair was white, and there were wrinkles around her eyes. I stared at it for a minute, then handed it to Dee Dee. This is her, too, I said. I'd look at her, and I'd see past the pounds and the years. I think every woman is beautiful, each in her own way. And my Dee Dee was the most beautiful of all. It's a shame you're not 50 years younger, she said. I could go for someone who feels that way. I didn't know what to say to that, so I said nothing. What did your wife die of? She asked at last. She was walking across the street, and some kid who was high on drugs came racing around the corner doing 70 miles an hour. She never knew what hit her. I paused, remembering that awful day. Kid got 6 months probation and lost his license. I lost Dee Dee. Did you see it happen? No, I was still inside the store, paying for the groceries. I heard it, though. Sounded like a clap of thunder. That's terrible. At least she didn't feel any pain, I said. I suppose there are worse ways to go. Slower ways, anyway. Most of my friends are busy discovering them. Now it was her turn to be at a loss for an answer. Finally, she looked at her watch. I have to go, Walter, she said. It's been interesting. Perhaps we could meet again, I suggested hopefully. She gave me a look that said all her worst fears were true after all. I'm not asking for a date, I continued hastily. I'm an old man. I'd just like to talk to you again. It'd be like being with Dee Dee again for a few minutes. I paused, half expecting her to tell me it was sick. But she didn't say anything. Look, I eat here all the time. What if you came back a week from today and we just talked during dinner? My treat. I promised not to follow you home, and I'm too arthritic to play footsie under the table. She couldn't repress a smile at my last remark. All right, Walter, she said. I'll be your ghost from 6 to 7. I was as nervous as a schoolboy a week later when 6 o'clock rolled around. I'd even worn a jacket and tie for the first time in months. I'd also cut myself in 3 places while shaving, but I hoped she wouldn't notice. 6 o'clock came and went, and so did 6:10. She finally entered the place at 15 after, in a blouse and slacks I could have sworn belonged to Dee Dee. I'm sorry I'm late, she said, sitting down opposite me. I was reading, and I lost track of time. Let me guess, I said. Jane Austen. How did you know, she said, surprised. She was Dee Dee's favorite. I didn't say she was my favorite, said Deirdre. But she is, isn't she? I persisted. There was an uncomfortable pause. Yes, she said at last. We ordered our dinner. Of course, she had the eggplant parmesan. It was what Dee Dee always had. And then she pulled a couple of magazines out of her bag, one full-sized, one a digest, and showed me some illustrations she had done. Very good, I said. Especially this one of the little blonde girl and the horse. Reminds me of something your wife did. I nodded. Long time ago. I haven't thought of it for years. I always liked it, but she felt she'd done many better ones. Oh, I've done better too, said Deirdre. But these were handy. We spoke a little more before the meal came. I tried to keep it general, because I could see all these parallels with Dee Dee were making her uncomfortable. Vincenzo had his walls covered by photos of famous Italians. She knew Frank Sinatra and Dean Martin and Joe DiMaggio, but I spent a few minutes explaining what Carmine Basilio and Eddie Arcaro and some of the others had done to deserve such enshrinement. You know, I said as the salads arrived, Dee Dee had a beautiful leather-bound set of Jane Austen's works. I never read them, and they're just sitting there gathering dust. I'd be happy to give them to you next week. Oh, I couldn't, she said. They must be worth a small fortune. A very small one, I said. Besides, when I die, they'll just wind up in the garbage, or maybe at Goodwill. Don't talk about dying like that, she said. Like what? So matter-of-factly. The closer you get to it, the more a matter-of-fact it becomes, I said. Don't worry, I added lightly. I promise not to die before dinner's over. Now, about those Austen books? I could see her struggling with herself. You're sure, she said at last. I'm sure. You can have a matched set of the Brontes, too, if you like. Thank you, but I don't really like them. It figured. I don't think Dee Dee had ever cracked any of them open. All right, I said, just the Austen. I'll bring them next week. Suddenly she frowned. I don't think I can make it next week, Walter, she said. My fiancé has been away on business, and I'm pretty sure that's the day he comes home. Your fiancé, I repeated. You haven't mentioned him before. We've only spoken twice, she replied. I wasn't hiding the fact. Well, good for you, I said. You must know by now that I'm a believer in marriage. I guess I am, too, she said. You guess. Oh, I believe in marriage. Just don't know if I believe in marriage with Ron. Then why are you engaged to him? She shrugged. I'm 31. It was time. And he's nice enough. But, I asked, there's a but in there somewhere. But I don't know if I want to spend the rest of my life with him. She paused, puzzled. Now why did I tell you that? I don't know, I replied. Why do you think you did? I don't know either, she said. I just have this feeling I can confide in you. I appreciate that, I said. As for spending the rest of your life with your young man, well, the way everyone gets married and divorced these days, maybe you won't have to. You sure know how to cheer a girl up, Walter, she said wryly. I apologize. Your private life is none of my business. I meant no offense. Fine. Then, what shall we talk about? I thought about Dee Dee. Sooner or later, we talked about everything under the sun. But her greatest passion was the theater. Whose work do you like better, Tom Stoppard's or Edward Albee's? Her face lit up, and I could tell she was going to spend the next 10 minutes telling me exactly who she preferred and why. Somehow, I wasn't surprised. We skipped the following week, but met every week thereafter for the next 3 months. Ron even came along once, probably to make sure I was as old and unattractive as she described me. He must have satisfied himself on those counts, because he never came back. He seemed a nice enough young man, and he was clearly in love with her. I ran into her twice at my local Borders, and once at Barnes & Noble, and both times I bought her coffee. I knew I was falling in love with her. Hell, I'd been in love with her from the first moment I saw her. But that's where it got confusing, because I knew I wasn't really in love with her. I was in love with a younger version of Dee Dee that she represented. Ron had to leave town on another business trip, and while he was gone, she took me to the theater to see a revival of Stoppard's Jumpers, and I took her to the racetrack to watch a minor stakes race for fillies. The play was nice enough, a little obscure, but well acted. I don't think she liked the color and excitement of the track any more than Dee Dee had. I kept wondering if she could somehow be Dee Dee reincarnated, but I knew deep in my gut that it wasn't possible. If she was Dee Dee, my Dee Dee, she'd have been put here for me. And this one was marrying a young man named Ron. Besides, she had a past. She had photos of herself as a little girl, friends who had known her for years. And Dee Dee had only been dead for 7 years. And while I didn't understand what was happening, I knew there couldn't have been two of her coexisting at the same time. No, I never asked myself why. I just knew it couldn't be. Sometimes, as a bit of an experiment, I'd order a wine or mention a play or a book or a movie that I knew Dee Dee hadn't liked. And invariably, Deirdre would wrinkle her nose and express her lack of enthusiasm for the very same thing. It was uncanny. And in a way, it was frightening, because I couldn't understand why it was happening. This wasn't my Dee Dee. Mine had lived her life with me, and that life was over. I was a 76-year-old man with half a dozen ailments who was just beating time on his way to the grave. I was never going to impose myself on Deirdre, and she was never going to look upon me as anything but an eccentric acquaintance. So why had I met her? From time to time, I'd had this romantic fancy that when two people loved each other and suited each other the way Dee Dee and I did, they'd keep coming back over and over again. Once they'd be Adam and Eve, once they'd be Lancelot and Guinevere, once they'd be Bogart and Bacall, but they'd be together. They wouldn't be an old man and a young woman who could never connect. I had half a century's worth of experiences we could never share. I was sure the thought of my touching her would make her skin crawl. And I was long past the point where I could do anything but touch her. So whether she was my Dee Dee reborn or just a Dee Dee, why were the two of us here at this time and in this place? I didn't know. But a few days later, I learned that I'd better find out pretty damn quick. Something finally showed up in all the tests I've been taking at the hospital. They put me on half a dozen new medications, gave me some powerful pain pills for when I needed them, and told me not to make any long-term plans. Hell, I wasn't even that unhappy about it. At least I'd be with my Dee Dee again, the real Dee Dee, not the charming substitute. The next night was our regular dinner date. I decided not to tell her the news. There was no sense distressing her. It turned out that she was distressed enough as it was. Ron had given her an ultimatum: set a date or break it off. Things had changed a lot since my day. Most of my contemporaries would have killed to have a gorgeous girlfriend who had no problem sleeping with them but got nervous at the thought of marriage. "So what are you going to do?" I asked sympathetically. "I don't know," she replied. "I'm fond of him, I really am, but I don't know." "Let him go," I said. She stared at me questioningly. "If you're not certain after all this time," I said, "kiss him off." She sighed deeply. "He's everything I should want in a husband, Walter. He's thoughtful and considerate. We share a lot of interests. And he's got a fine future as an architect." She smiled ruefully. "I even like his mother." "But," I prompted her, But I don't think I love him. She stared into my eyes. I always thought I'd know right away. At least that's the myth I was brought up on as a little girl. And it was reinforced by all the romance novels I read and all the movies I saw. How was it for you on your deity? Did you ever have any doubts?
Never a one, I said. Not from the first moment to the last.
I'm 31, Walter, she said unhappily. If I haven't met the right guy yet, what are the odds he's going to show up before I'm 40 or 60? What if I want to have a baby? Do I have it with a man I don't love? Or with a guy I love who's living 6 states away before it's even born? She sighed unhappily. I have 2 good friends who married the men of their dreams. They're both divorced. My closest friend married a nice guy she wasn't sure she loved. She's been happily married for 10 years and keeps telling me I'm crazy if I let Ron get away. She stared across the table at me, a tortured expression on her face. I'd give everything I have to be as sure of a man, any man, as you were of your deity.
And that was when I knew why I'd met her, and why the medics had given me a few more months atop planet Earth before I spent the rest of eternity beneath it. We finished the meal, and for the first time ever, I walked her home. She lived in one of those high-rise apartment buildings, kind of a miniature city in itself. It wasn't fancy enough to have a doorman, but she assured me the security system was state-of-the-art. She kissed me on the cheek while a couple of neighbors who were coming out looked at her as if she was crazy. I waited until she was safely in the elevator, then left and returned home. When I woke up the next morning, I decided it was time to get busy. At least I was going to be in familiar locations where I felt comfortable. I got dressed and went out to the track. Spent a few hours in the grandstand near the furlong pole, where I always got the best view of the races, and didn't lay a single bet, just hung around. Then, after dinner, I started making the rounds of all my favorite bookstores. I spent the next 2 afternoons at the zoo and the Natural History Museum, where I'd spent so many happy afternoons with Dee Dee, and the one after that at the ballpark in the left field bleachers. I had to take a couple of pain pills along the way, but I didn't let it slow me down. I continued my circuit of bookstores and coffee shops in the evenings. On the 6th night, I decided I was getting tired of Italian food. Hell, I was getting tired, period. And I went to the Olympus, another restaurant I've been frequenting for years. It doesn't look like much. No Greek statues, not even any belly dancers or bouzouki players. But it serves the best pasticcio and domates in town. And that's where I saw him. His face didn't jump right out at me the way Deirdre's did, but then I hadn't really looked at it in a long time. He was alone. I waited until he got up to go to the men's room, and then followed him in.
"Nice night," I said when we were washing our hands. "If you say so," he answered unenthusiastically. "The air is clear, the moon is out, there's a lovely breeze, and the possibilities are endless," I said. "What could be better?" "Look, fella," he said irritably, "I just broke up with my girl, and I'm in no mood for talk, okay? I just need to ask you a couple of questions, Wally." "How do you know my name?" he demanded. I shrugged. "You look like a Wally." He cast a quick look at the door. "What the hell's going on? You try anything funny and I'll..." "Not to worry," I said. "I'm just a used-up old man trying to do one last good deed on the way to the grave." I pulled an ancient photo out of my wallet and held it up. "Look at all familiar?" He frowned. "I don't remember posing for that. Did you take it?" "A friend did." "Who's your favorite actor?"
"Humphrey Bogart. Why?"
"Of course. Bogey had been my favorite since I was a kid. Just curious. Last question. What do you think of Agatha Christie?"
"Why?"
"I'm curious."
He stared at me for a minute, then shrugged. "I can't stand her.
Murders take place in back alleys, not vicarages.
It figured. I'd always hated mystery novels where the murder was committed primarily to provide the detective with a corpse.
Good answer, Wally. What are you smiling about? He asked suspiciously.
I'm happy.
I'm glad one of us is.
Tell you what, I said. Maybe I can cheer you up, too. You know a restaurant called Vincenzo's? A little Italian place about 3 blocks east of here?
Yeah, I stop in there every now and then. Why?
I want you to be my guest for dinner tomorrow night.
Still, why?
I'm an old man with nothing to spend my money on, I said. Why don't you humor me?
He considered it, then shrugged. Oh, what the hell? I don't have anyone to eat with anyway.
Temporarily, I replied.
What are you talking about?
Just show up, I said.
Then, as I walked to the door, I turned back to him and smiled.
Have I got a girl for you?
And that was our story. It got me thinking what I would do if I ran into the analog of my younger self. I'd probably want to slap him. So, we follow our Mike Resnick story up with feedback on a Mike Resnick story. Seems we keep doing that. Escape Pod 152, The Big Guy, about a philosophical robot basketball player, didn't knock anybody's athletic socks off, but seemed to go over pretty well. In fact, the commentary was unusually uniform. Wintermute's reaction was very typical. He said, I thought this one was great fun. The league okaying robots seems implausible, but I didn't really care. Most people were in agreement on that point, that the reactions of the people in the story to having robots and humans playing side by side, and the narrator being okay with being benched, didn't seem all that realistic. People also agreed that the ending was predictable. The variation was whether they disliked the story for these traits or liked it despite them. Uriel 1998 said, Mike Resnick delivered a story that was pretty predictable, yet told so well that I found myself enjoying it anyway, which is a better hallmark of a tale-teller than original ideas any day. We had a digression from Roni, who's confused by us Americans and our obsession with statistics and sports. Can't we just watch the damn games? Tango Alpha Delta agrees. Why is it that we obsess over sports statistics, but we're still generally so bad at math? In any case, it turned out that there are a lot of SF and sports fans in our audience. As Dave NJ said, I just don't see why I can't have it all. He also liked the story. Quote, oddly prescient, though, as Memphis just lost the NCAA championship on 3 bricked FTs in the final minute and a half to send the game to OT. I suppose I shouldn't admit that I didn't even know the Final Four was happening when the story ran. I'll just say it was my very precise, very strategic scheduling. Stop laughing, Professor. Escape Pod is a production of Escape Artists Incorporated and is distributed on a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives 3.0 license. You know, I don't even have any macros when I script this. I type that every time. That's how much I care. I also really hope that if you like this story, you'll tell a friend or blog about us. And if you can, please consider donating via the PayPal link at our site. I mentioned the other podcasts in the intro. They're at podcastle.org and pseudopod.org. And you can buy archive CDs at poddisc.com. Our music is by permission of Daikaiju. For our closing... No, not on a PG-rated episode. But check out First of May by Jonathan Colton, if you're over 18, and celebrate. That was our show for this week. Our closing quotation comes from Marcel Proust, who said, "Our memory is like a shop in the window of which is exposed now one, now another photograph of the same person. And as a rule, the most recent exhibit remains for some time the only one to be seen." We'll see you next week, the 8th of May. Meanwhile, have fun.